Let me introduce him, just so you know who he is exactly. He's the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and founder and director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. He's also frequently a visiting professor at Harvard Law School, where he taught civil liberties and the philosophy of law, among other subjects. So you've been teaching at Harvard. Keep trying. Keep trying. He's the author of Clash of Orthodoxies, Conscience and Its Enemies, and other books, including What is Marriage, Man and Woman? Please welcome Robert B. George. I will begin some questions and conversation with Robbie. Are there any other questions? I don't see these bashful young men that... Okay. Oh, there they are. Okay. Thank you. Let me grab you a mic.
Jim, if I could begin before you ask me a question, I just want to say how honored and thrilled I am to be on the program with Pat McCaskey. As you can imagine, Pat, your grandfather was a major figure in my family. I shared with Jim a story that I hope Pat will appreciate. Perhaps some of the others of you will find it interesting as well. So Bill, before he died, but after he had retired from football, from playing and coaching, was visiting us one day, and it was in my senior year of college. And I had just gotten my law school admissions. I'd been applying to law schools, and I was admitted to several law schools, and the subject turned to that at dinner. And Bill said, "Well, where are you thinking of going?" And I said, "Well, it's hard to decide. You know, I've gotten into some very good law schools, Harvard, Yale, the University of Chicago." And he said, "The University of Chicago? Don't go there. That place is filled with communists." That's only because he'd lived in Chicago and didn't know the situation in New Haven in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They were all filled.
That's a great story. Is this on? Well, speaking of schools filled with communists, not communism per se, but I did want to ask you about the topic of patriarchy and just how that has been treated at various college institutions. Do you have a sense of the evolution of kind of how a patriarchy has been presented, demeaned? Do you see that at Princeton? Are there any observations you can make just about the academic culture and patriarchy, and also how it impacts some of the male students on campus? Any thoughts about that?
Well, my training, both as an undergraduate and then when I finished law school, my doctoral training is in philosophy. And the central thing about philosophy is distinguishing. That's what philosophers do. That's what we do for a living. We distinguish this from that. And part of that project is distinguishing the various senses in which terms are used, especially terms that become part of contested political and cultural and moral and religious discourse. And so we need to distinguish what we mean by the term patriarchy. And of course, very often in the discourse today, no distinctions are drawn. And so we have these conversations, and it's unclear what people are talking about. Now, today, certainly in the environment in which I labor, patriarchy is a bad thing. It's got a very negative connotation. Patriarchy is something that we're against. So we have to ask the question, well, what does that mean when you say patriarchy? If it means women are regarded as inferior to men in worth and dignity, well, I'm against that. If that's what patriarchy is, I'm against it. If it means that men get to boss women around all the time, I'm against that too. I didn't grow up that way. I come from a very traditional family, but my mother didn't get bossed around by my father. He wasn't the kind who bossed people around. She wouldn't have put up with it if he tried. So that isn't it. Does it mean we countenance violence against women? Now, very often in the contemporary discourse, that does seem to be part of what is being suggested by the term patriarchy. What couldn't possibly be more against that? What Christian couldn't be fundamentally, decisively, profoundly against that? So if we're against all those things, does that mean we're against patriarchy? Well, of course, there are other senses of the term patriarchy. When I think of my father, who will tomorrow turn 93, brave, heroic, World War II veteran, honored for his valor with induction into the Legion of Honor of France. When I think of my beloved father, a strong man, a self-disciplined man, I think of him as our patriarch. Mm. He is the patriarch of the George family. I want to be like him, knowing that I will never be able to be like him. When my father does go on to his reward, and I hope it's not for a very long time, but he's 93, I shudder to think I will be the senior male member of the George family. I will be expected to be the patriarch like my father. I know I can't fill those shoes. In that sense of patriarch, well, yes, that's a different thing altogether. I'm certainly for that. Papa Bear, George Halas, was the patriarch not only of the Halas family, but of the Bears family. Patriarch then, in that sense, of course, has a very positive connotation. Now, if patriarch means strong, and not only strong, but dedicated, and not only dedicated, but willing to make sacrifices, and not only willing to make sacrifices, but willing to make sacrifices in the service of people whom he loves and to whom he has obligations. Boy, if that's what we mean by a patriarch, then I do want to be a patriarch. And I think all men should want to be patriarchs. We should aspire to being people who serve others with self-sacrificial love. That, I think, is the positive sense of patriarch or patriarchy that we have in mind when we talk about George Halas as the patriarch of the Bears family, or when we talk about the scriptural patriarchs, strong men, men who serve, men who are willing to sacrifice. Truly what, I don't know if other people say this, but I hear my Baptist friends use the term servant leader. I think that's a great term. And that's what patriarchs, true patriarchs in the positive sense are. They're servant leaders. They don't boss people around. They serve them. Part of how they serve them is by exercising leadership in a self-sacrificial way.
Well, they may still tell somebody what to do sometimes.
Right? My father would sometimes tell us boys, there were five of us, five boys, and he would tell us what to do. Yes, that's right.
I've had the honor of meeting your father on several occasions, and then I found out he was actually subscribing to and reading Touchstone and actually had sent in some support for it as well. So I'm very honored by that. He was a good, he is a very fine man, and you're lucky too.
Let me tell you a story about him. When I was 12 years old and my youngest brother was 2, the five of us had a 10-year spread. We were spending a summer at a home in the country along a creek in Appalachia called the Dunkard Creek. And about a half an acre away, across an open field, was the house next door. And in the house next door lived a couple He had been a roofer, worked on roofs. His name was Donzel. And his wife was named Marie. Donzel must have been in his early 40s at the time. But he had had an accident while roofing. He had fallen off a roof and broken his back, and he was permanently in a wheelchair, paraplegia. And the couple had a lot of marital problems. And they would fight very loudly. They would argue very loudly. And when that would happen, my parents would try to distract us. Because even with that half acre, you could when they were yelling at each other that loudly, you could hear what was going on over there. But at other times, when things were peaceful, we'd go over and we'd visit Donzel, and we'd sit there. He'd be in his wheelchair. We'd sit talking with him under the tree. We enjoyed that, and our parents thought that was a good thing to do. That was a nice thing to do for our paralyzed neighbor. Well, Donzel believed that his wife, who's, as I said, named Marie, was stepping out on him. So when she would drive off in a car, he would often be upset that she was going to see people she shouldn't be seeing. And he would often threaten to kill her, to kill himself, and this would get extremely nasty. Well, one day, Marie got in her car. She drove off. There was lots of shouting and screaming before this happened. After a few minutes, we heard an enormous explosion, and the house blew up on fire like a bomb. He had somehow, despite being in his wheelchair, managed to close off all the windows, fill in the gaps, turn on the gas, and light a match. And the house was a ball of flame. I've never seen, it was a huge explosion. The house was a ball of flame. I'd never seen anything like that before in my life. My parents, of course, were startled, immediately gathered all of us up. My mother took us into our house and literally had her arms around the five of us in a huddle as my father dashed across the half acre into the house to rescue Donzel, who was a big paralyzed man whom he had to drag out of there, which he did. Now that's self-sacrificial leadership. Now, it was clear, I mean, my mother's a strong and brave woman. Had my father not been there, my mother would have put us in the house and run across and try to rescue him herself. But since my father was there, it seemed to him and seemed to my mother that her role was to comfort us and protect us, and his was to go and rescue Donzel, which somehow miraculously he managed to do without losing his own life. That image, that whole experience is burned into my memory and has been very formative in my way of thinking about things.
Yeah, we've talked at this conference about, you know, the role of protection, of provision, also protection. As a society, we seem to be failing boys in many ways, preparing them in this direction. Why do you think that's so? Boys are underperforming girls academically to the point at which many colleges and universities have a female to male enrollment ratio of, I think, 60 to 40 or greater. Boys are disproportionately committers and victims of crimes, including crimes of violence. Incarceration, drug and alcohol abuse rates have skyrocketed for boys. What's going on?
Well, it's not a good situation. It's not good for boys, and obviously it's not good for girls.
And the consequences of this.
Yeah. I commented in social media. I've tweeted out a couple of times. I tweeted it, and it offended enough people that it caused me to tweet it again a few months later, that parents, if you want your boy, your sons, not to turn out to be a predator, raise him to be a protector. And I think that is the right advice. Now, that doesn't mean to raise him to treat women as damsels in distress who can never take care of themselves, have no gumption, have no minds of their own, have no strength, have no brain. That's not it. teach your boys to be protectors, not only of girls who may happen to be in trouble, but of other boys who happen to be in trouble. My father and mother raised us to be the boys who protected the boy who was being bullied by other boys. Hmm. You bring up sons like that, if you valorize that, if you reward that, if you encourage that, they're not going to be predators against women or anybody else. I don't understand the psychology nearly perfectly. In fact, I don't understand it well at all. But there is something, I think, in the males of the human species and of other species as well, actually. Mm. Something that the Greeks, help me, Jay Budashevsky, on this. I think what the Greeks called thymos, right? It's sometimes transliterated as T-H-Y-M-O-S, sometimes T-H-U-M-O-S, thymos, which seems to be this drive, this spirit that can be channeled in positive ways. But if it's not channeled in positive ways, it very likely is to go in negative ways. What happens when you don't raise a boy to be a protector is it often gets channeled in negative ways. And he's a boy who picks on other boys, a boy who doesn't learn to treat women with dignity and respect as fully and truly his equal in worth and dignity. Someone who's out for satisfying his own lusts and desires, not someone who honors other people, including women, including the woman to whom he may be eventually married. But if you channel it in the right direction, you channel it in the direction of being a protector, you're going to get all the plus and not the minus. You're going to get a protector, which in itself is a good thing, and you're going to avoid the disaster of being a predator. We've got a lot of predatory boys and men out there. A lot. Mm. A lot. All classes, all races, all conditions of life. They're on Wall Street. They're in the worst areas of Chicago. They're all over the place. Now, who brought up those boys to be those men? What is missing in the equation? Why weren't they brought up to be protectors? How did they end up being predators? Now, on your point about failing boys, you're absolutely right. If you look at academic achievement these days, the girls are outperforming the boys massively. At many colleges and universities, co-ed institutions, which most are these days, of course, you've got 60-40 or even 70-30 girls to boys. In itself, just considered an abstraction, there's nothing wrong with that. But you do wonder why the boys are so badly underachieving. And on top of that, of course, it skews the mating market in a significant way. There are not enough marriageable boys for the girls. Now, history and sociology teach us that's not as bad as if it were the other way around. If you have not enough, this is China. China is facing this right now. Not enough girls for the boys. Because if you have a lot of unattached males, you're going to have trouble. There does seem to be something about the male-female relationship in which women can have and often do have a very positive civilizing effect on men. When there aren't women in the picture to perform that function, men can go very badly off the rails. What you say about, of course, the prisons is absolutely right. Violent crime. We have a lot of violent crime today involving women, but it's nothing compared to what we have involving men. And many people have noted that our situation in schools now is problematic for our young children, our young boys in particular. There's a very strong temptation to over-medicate the boys. Now, I'm told by people, well, I served for a number of years on the President's Council on Bioethics during the administration of President George H.W. Bush, and we looked at a lot of issues. You'll remember the embryonic stem cell issue was central to our deliberations over my 7 years on the council. But one of the issues we looked at was Ritalin and other drugs used to treat ADD and ADHD and related syndromes and symptoms. The experts in the field with whom I talked tended to believe that there were appropriate uses for those drugs, but but they were being massively overused, overprescribed. They were being used when they shouldn't be used, as well as the rarer occasions in which they should be used. They were being used because boys, little boys, tend to be fidgety and get easily distracted. You need teachers, and we need parents, who are willing to take the time and invest the attention into teaching and caring for and dealing with fidgety, wiggly boys. If we medicate them, the long-term consequences of that are not going to be good. We shouldn't use drugs as a substitute for teaching and parenting. And too often that seems to be what we're doing.
Let's take some questions from young men here.
So this
your name?
My name's Peter Cardillo. This is kind of going off what some of the other speakers have brought up this morning, and then this last question of flawed maleness and prolonged adolescence, which is what would occur, like if parents weren't good parents, and then into college. And Mr. Kushner was telling us at lunch that he wanted us to bring up a good question here, and something I thought of was just like, what do we do once there's men in college that have already experienced this with either having parenting that wasn't there, or now they're in college and that flawed maleness is kind of just like taking charge. So I guess what's the next step, like to create a better maleness and a true masculinity in our culture of young men, so that that prolonged adolescence doesn't continue?
Yeah. Well, I think we need to encourage and lift up self-sacrifice. I think the people we should be looking up to and encouraging our young men to look up to are people who are willing to sacrifice themselves for others and for causes that they regard as greater than themselves. We just need a lot more role models. Certainly one of our problems is a lot of boys just don't have father figures in their lives. One of the things that we're going to have to figure out how to deal with is just the sheer reality of 40% of American children being born out of wedlock, and in most cases that means without their fathers in their lives. That's a really terrible situation. We're so used to it now. We're so accustomed to it that we don't pause to reflect on how catastrophic that is. Individually, for the boys who are missing their fathers, and for our society because of the social consequences, the pathologies that follow in the train of widespread fatherlessness. Daniel Patrick Moynihan saw this coming back in 1965 when he issued his famous and very controversial report. He saw it happening in one segment of American society, historically victimized, discriminated against African-American community. He saw exactly what that would mean for that community. And when it goes across the society, it's easy to see what the consequences are for the broader society as well. But one thing we can do, I think, is call attention to, lift up, encourage people who are willing to sacrifice themselves for higher things. That if there's a bad masculinity, then the good masculinity is the masculinity that's self-sacrificial, that channels that thumos for the sake of something great, that is willing to take risks, not for the thrill of risk-taking, which is very common among boys. The reason boys have many more car accidents than girls, the reason that boys are more likely to take terrible risks with drugs and alcohol and stuff like that, the reason for all that is that boys, and there's a biological basis for this, boys take longer to develop a reasonable fear of catastrophes. But I think we need to channel that willingness to take risks into good causes, not risks for the risks of, or for the thrill of risk-taking, but risks for the sake of others, risks for the sake of something good, for something noble.
Another question? Anyone else over there? I guess that's... What about... I know you've worked on campus at Princeton with the Elizabeth Anscombe Society and other student groups, and there's been, you know, concern about, sex on campus. I mean, obviously, that's got to be, you know, an issue that really has repercussions, effects on both sexes and the whole culture of that. I mean, is there any advice that you could give to both parents, but also, let's say, high school boys, girls, preparing, surviving, and going to college, and then navigating this whole kind of minefield?
Well, one thing that I've been saying for 30 years now, since I published my book, Making Men Moral, my first book with Oxford University Press, is that culture matters. I know this is not a big surprise to most people, but in the academic world, it turns out to be a big surprise. Culture matters. If you allow a hookup culture, a culture of sexual promiscuity, to develop anywhere, but certainly on college campuses, if you allow that to develop and flourish, and you don't try to do anything about it, there are going to be terribly adverse consequences for everybody concerned, for the institution, for the young men who are involved, for the young women who are involved, and so forth. And the reason culture really matters in this and other areas is that the idea of the individual free chooser, an abstraction from cultural norms and cultural conditions, is a kind of libertarian myth. It doesn't exist. Culture plays a very, whether it's the small culture of a university community or the larger culture of the United States of America or the West, culture, for better or for worse, and sometimes for better and sometimes for worse, has a shaping impact on people. It conditions the choices they make. It influences the choices they make. In a hookup culture, if a girl wants company, if a girl wants attention, male attention, if a girl doesn't want to be lonely, she's got to play. It's not her abstract libertarian free choice to participate or not. Now, in a certain sense, it is. She could be lonely. That's true. She could say, I'm not going to play. I'm not going to get in the game. I'll have a different life. Most girls are not going to opt for that, at least in my experience with universities today. They will fall into it. They'll be unhappy about it. They'll drink themselves into a stupor in order to steel themselves to play in the hookup culture, but they will play. Culture shapes conduct, and rules, norms, laws shape culture. The reason things are one way in Amish country when it comes to personal relationships and sexuality and so forth, and another way in Greenwich Village or San Francisco, is not that, well, it just happens to be the free choices of people in Amish country to do this and the free choices of people in Greenwich Village and San Francisco to do that. Culture has a central conduct-shaping role wherever culture exists, which is everywhere. So the question we ought to be asking ourselves in colleges and universities and more broadly is, what kind of culture do we want? What's a healthy and good culture? What sort of culture do we want shaping our choices and the choices of our children and grandchildren? And then how do we get there? I mean, it's one thing to decide what a superior culture is. It's another thing to figure out the right way to get there. There are also wrong ways to try to get there. There are authoritarian or totalitarian ways to try to get there, and we don't want to do that. Means as well as ends really matter. But we need to figure out what kind of a culture we want and then think about how to move from the situation, highly deficient, highly defective situation that we're in, say on college and university campuses, to a superior one.
But to change a culture or to swim against the stream or to, you know, fight against it, that's going to take some risk. It's going to take willingness, that was something we've talked about here, willingness to, to be hated.
Unpopular, hated. Yeah, right.
All that.
What it's going to take is courage.
It's going to take courage.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to take courage from men, and it's going to take courage from women. You're going to have to be willing to be called names, to be vilified, to be looked down on, to not be one of the cool kids. But look, whoever said life was going to be easy, especially for a Christian? I mean, Jesus didn't say, you know, come and follow me because it's going to be great.
Yeah, I think, prosperity gospel. There.
If you want to be my disciple, you've got to take up your cross and follow me. And sometimes that means making yourself the target of defamation, vilification. But that is what we're called to do. We need to make those kinds of sacrifices, and we need to muster the courage to be willing to do it.
That has to become the kind of the dominant culture within the church among Christians, is that we are going to take on these issues. I don't really sense that that's a regular theme. I mean, you find, you know, isolated battles here and there. I mean, in this audience here is someone who took on a culture. My friend Peter Cardillo, local school board in New Jersey, just saw some very bad sex education material in the library, took it to the school board. They turned it, they did a review, they turned it down. He kept going back several times.
Like the woman before the unjust judge in Jesus's parable, exactly, yeah.
I'm sure that it wasn't easy. You know, you realize, I'm sure in that room you had to feel like there's all sorts of people think that you have two heads, you're a monster, or you're really unenlightened, you're barbaric, but to have a culture in the church that encourages engagement, but it has to be done wisely, of course, but still courage has to be at the center of it. You sense that is something we still need to kind of generate? It's not really, we don't either sense the dangers yet enough.
Oh, no. I think people sense the dangers. I think the problem is a want of courage. The temptation is always to go silent or acquiesce, because we know that the consequences can be very severe. But we just need to muster the courage. And certainly within the church, we need to encourage, put courage in each other to stand up. Now, there are people... Rachel Brown, who's here, has exemplified that courage. Tony Esselin has exemplified that courage. You know, it wasn't easy for them. It's not easy for them today. They're victims of vilification and defamation and all kinds of crazy stuff. People get up petitions against them. This is what happens when you stand up against the prevailing orthodoxies. You defy the prevailing winds. But we just have to do it. And we have to support each other when we do it. You know, it's not enough just to say, I'm going to hold your coat. You go participate in the fight. We have to be willing to step out and defend people who have been wronged. When they've been wronged, especially when they've been wronged for themselves exemplifying courage and taking risks, standing up for what's right. There's a big need for this in the academic world. And there's certainly a big need in the church. Now look, that when I say exemplify courage, please don't interpret that as be mean. That's not what I'm asking people to do. It's not what I do myself. Yes, speak truth in love. You know, be kind. Certainly be gentle as doves, even as we're being cunning as serpents. But also be tough and be bold and be brave. Speak the truth, not in a mean way, in a loving way, but speak the truth. It's not loving to not speak the truth. That's not loving. Telling people that they're doing what's right when they're doing what's wrong is not being loving, and usually just being a coward. So, you know, don't scream and shout, and don't be uncivil, and, you know, don't be mean. but be strong and be firm and be clear and be willing to engage, be willing to listen. You probably know about the work Cornel West and I do together. Cornel and I don't agree about most things, but we do have some deep agreements as well, and those agreements enable us to carry on our discussions in a civil and productive way where we engage each other. Part of, I think, the courage that's required is the courage to permit ourselves to be subjected to criticism from those on the other side. You know, if we're going to engage, for example, with people who favor abortion, we need to stand up for the sanctity of human life, but we also need to be willing to entertain their arguments, have a fair and open argument, and to listen to them. I'm willing to do that. I mean, I'm willing to engage in these dialogues with people like my colleague Peter Singer. Now, I'm pretty confident that Peter's wrong about this. I think I'm on the right side of this, and Peter's on the wrong side. But I think we, those of us on the pro-life side, have to have the courage to be able to speak firmly and clearly in defense of the child in the womb, but also the courage to listen to see what people on the other side have to say.
Well, I think you're, Robbie, I think you're especially gifted in these kinds of encounters with the other side, so to speak. Personally, I wouldn't personally put myself in a position of, you know, debating with all sorts of people on the other side, because I just don't think I have the intellectual or thinking on my feet kind of ability to walk away from that, especially if other people are watching it. So I think it's a unique calling that you have, particularly, and those who are able to do it, to do it.
I don't agree with that.
Okay.
It could be across the table from your cousin at Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And
that's different.
She's probably not an academic. You might not be an academic or philosopher. But if she's on, you know, what she calls the pro-choice side, and the subject comes up, there's an opportunity to engage. And I think you should seize the opportunity. I don't think you should worry too much about ruining everybody else's Thanksgiving dinner. I think you should seize. How often are you going to get to see her after all? You know?
Yes. Yeah.
So I think you should engage, but engage lovingly. Don't just lecture her. And listen to her. See what argument she has. What is it that has caused her to go this way? I mean, I think it's the right thing to do in principle. Also, practically, she's probably much more likely to listen to you explain how you got to where you are if you're doing her the courtesy of listening to her give her account of how she got to where she is. Now, I think all of us, especially on the great issues of the day, even if we're not academics, all of us need to inform ourselves. You know, we need to be witnesses. And that requires a bit of work. Read Touchstone.
Yeah.
You know, there's... those of us who are writing for Touchstone aren't just kind of entertaining ourselves and getting paid $50 or $75, whatever you're paying now. You know, we're supplying you with arguments, with evidence, with data, with information that you need to use as witnesses with your family members and your friends and your coworkers and anyone you're engaging out there in the culture. These great battles, and they're so important, they're just so important to the dignity of our fellow human beings and ourselves as human beings. These great battles have to be fought, but they're fought one conversation at a time. It's not just some big presidential election or something like that where they're fought. They're fought over water coolers or over Thanksgiving dinner tables or at the church hall and coffee after the service and a million other little places. And we need to be good witnesses. And I do not give you permission. You are not allowed to excuse yourself from witnessing because, oh gosh, I'm not an academic and I'm not that good at arguments and I don't know that much and so forth. Nope, not buying that. Inform yourselves, be prepared, go out there and witness.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we're at our break time.
Question. I'm just a simple Lutheran pastor in a small town.
I'm a country
town,
lawyer myself.
And I hear what you mean about courage. But what I find is that oftentimes it's a lack of knowing that they actually have authority to speak, right? That they've been given, they've been authorized by the scriptures to speak the truth. And they don't have courage because they don't know they have authority. Where does that play into patriarchy, into fatherhood, or just, you know, living as men or women in our culture today, reclaiming authority and its proper understanding?
We live in what I sometimes call the age of feeling, and it's a huge problem. Do you know how historians like to break the epochs up into the age of this and the age of that, and the age that Rachel studies is called the medieval period is called the age of faith, and the Enlightenment is called the age of reason or the age of science. Those are statements about authority, right? So they're oversimplifications, but there's some truth there, actually. The age of faith, it's faith that has authority. It's the teachings of the church. It's scripture that has authority. In the age of reason, it's science that has authority. It's rationality that has authority. Well, in the age of feeling, what has authority? Feeling. So people think they can win an argument, they can trump a counter-argument by saying, essentially, whether they use the word or not, this is how I feel. And I think we just have to be clear that we don't accept that. We're not playing by those rules. Who is it, Jordan Peterson who says, or Ben Shapiro, I guess, one of those guys, who says, facts don't care about your feelings. And while that might sound a little harsh, it points to an underlying truth. You know, when people try to respond by invoking the authority of their feelings, we should make clear that we don't recognize the authority of feelings. Feelings are subjective. We need to insist on the authority of reasons. We need to know what are your reasons for this position. Reasons are objective. They're public. They can be subjected to criticism. If you say, I think I'm a hippopotamus because I feel like I'm a hippopotamus. There's nothing I can say to that. I mean, you know, I can't get inside your head.
You don't feel like one of me.
Right, but you know, but if you give me some reasons for why you think you're a hippopotamus, we can have something to talk about.